we are gone and forgotten, our buildings will keep on proclaiming that here have lived people who had a heart for the needs of children. Reverend Klein, 1929.
Even though the buildings are gone, my son Andy and I have uncovered the long-forgotten stories of the people who lived there, worked there, and died there. They were at the same time ordinary and extraordinary, and we hope you will be inspired by the sacrifices they made. By sharing their stories, we ensure that the people who had a heart for the needs of children will be remembered. Welcome to The Homes. My name is Karen Thaliker.
And I'm Andrew Newell. We're your hosts as we explore the challenges and joys of life at an institution housing orphans and old folks in rural Iowa during the year 1929. Welcome to September of 1929. On September 3rd, 1929, the stock market reached an 8-year high, and as President Hoover ended his first 6 months in office on September 5th, his accomplishments were set out in detail by the Associated Press and newspapers across the country, with headlines that read, "Hoover spends busy first 6 months as President of United States." The article highlighted his selection of a cabinet and the reorganization of large government departments. He was working on eliminating wasteful spending in the Army, relieving congestion in federal prison, and also exploring new policies in Indian affairs and child welfare. The new Federal Farm Board was also up and running.
The United Press and even London's The Guardian newspaper were a bit more non-committal about the first 6 months and had similar themes. The Guardian headline was, "The Engineer as Head of State, Mr. Hoover's First 6 Months, Still an Enigma." The United Press headline was, "Hoover 6 months in office and yet no sobriquet. President derives personal satisfaction from not being cataloged and tagged." A person's sobriquet is their nickname or how they're referred to. William Shakespeare was the Bard. Calvin Coolidge was Silent Cal. The United Press summed it up this way: "Hoover has evaded the great American urge to classify and symbolize a new administration with a single word or phrase. He had fished more than most presidents in recent years, but he is not the fisherman president. He has made only 3 public addresses, but he is not silent Herbert Hoover. He has demanded drastic retrenchment measures in the post office and war departments, and yet has not inspired the term Hoover economy. The fact that he has escaped for 6 months the single word characterization is held to signalize an executive and administrative policy of such flexibility it must be described rather than characterized. At least this harmonizes perfectly with President Hoover's own pre-election definition of the chief executive office. The presidency," he said, "is more than an administrative office. It must be the symbol of American ideals. The high and the lowly must be seen with the same eyes, met in the same spirit. It must be the instrument by which national conscience is livened, and it must, under the guidance of the Almighty, interpret and follow the conscience."
A leisurely examination of the first 6 months of the presidency ended quickly because on September 5th, stocks tumbled in what was called a dizzy nosedive. Some attributed the volatility in the markets to the prediction of one man, well-known economist and statistician Roger Babson. On September 5th, Babson gave a widely reported address to the National Business Conference, held in Wellesley Hill, Massachusetts. The United Press headline read, "Roger Babson predicts huge drop in stocks. Issues will fall 60 to 80 points inevitably, statistician asserts. Tells investor to pay up loans. Find market trend is not following leaders." The article continued, "Violent stock market reaction in the future was forecast here today by Roger W. Babson," noted statistician in an address before the 16th Annual National Business Conference. He advised investors to avoid margin speculation. Babson said it is inevitable that leading stocks would decline from 60 to 80 points. "Fair weather cannot always continue," he asserted. "The economic cycle is in progress today as in the past. The Federal Reserve System has put the banks in a strong position, but it has not changed human nature. More people are borrowing and speculating today than ever in our history. Sooner or later, there is a crash coming, and it may be a terrific one. Wise are those investors who now get out of debt and reef their sails."
The following day, the United Press reported on the aftermath of the volatility, where up to $1 billion was lost. The headline read, "Billion lost in stock market. Roger Babson's prediction of break realized. Speculation cause. Feverish bullish activities are blamed." The article acknowledged that although Wall Street blamed Babson at first, later people agreed that it was a natural correction of a top-heavy speculative position created in the feverish bullish activities of the last week. Babson would continue his predictions as well as his criticisms of the tariff bill, which would make him an easy target for politicians who were trying to reassure a nervous public that the economy was going to be okay.
At the Holmes, it seemed no area of life was untouched by financial concerns. A lack of funds could create problems in providing even basic necessities, such as having sufficient food on a daily basis, as well as building a sufficient food store for the winter. Here's an update from the September 1929 newsletter. "Perhaps our readers have never thought of the large amount of work it takes to feed about 100 people three times a day. Miss Bashforth is now in charge of our kitchen, and she finds her days are very full. All the cooking is now done in one kitchen, which we have the two dining rooms, one for the children and one for the old people. September is usually a busy month for the housewife, and we too have been canning and preparing for winter when we do not have the fresh vegetables and fruit. And we feel we do what we can towards feeding our large family. Quite a few tomatoes and apples were canned, also some sauerkraut, beans, and pepper relish was put up. Our men have been picking up the fallen apples, and occasionally they spend a day making cider. That takes care of our vinegar. Last Thursday, most of the ladies of the old people's home spent the day peeling apples, and Friday morning a large kettle was put over an open fire, and Mr. Mesh and Mr. Ramers took turns stirring the apple butter. They worked faithfully at it all day long, and in the evening it was put in crocks and was ready to be put away for use next winter."
Because of funding concerns, the children often had to do without. One of the extras that was provided was musical instruction and participation in a band. The September newsletter told of the orphans' band making a trip to Waverly to another Lutheran orphanage. Reverend Klein noted that they were treated royally. He wrote, "Such a splendid welcome makes one forget the many disagreeable things which often happen when so many are to be transported by bus." The orphans' band was most certainly a welcome activity for the children. Their instructor was Professor Elmer Ziegler, a well-known bandmaster and musician for Muscatine. In the February of 1930 newsletter, Professor Ziegler gave readers more details about the band. Here's what he wrote. "An institution such as this would be incomplete without music. In addition to the regular school program and singing that the teachers give, the Holmes have a band. This band was organized through the interest and help of the Muscatine Kiwanis Club about 3 years ago. One would naturally think, then, that the band, being 3 years old, should be a pretty good band by this time, but such is not the case. Instead of the same band being 3 years old, we really have our third band at the Holmes. The personnel of the institution changes so fast that the band leader doesn't have time to develop the children into fine players until they are gone. Only two or three members of the present band were members of the first band. It is interesting to note that this little orphan band does considerable traveling, very amateur though the organization is. Since its inception, the band has played engagements at the Mississippi Valley Fair in Davenport and the Synod in Clinton, Iowa. It has trooped all over the state of Illinois, playing 11 concerts in 9 days. It played for the Synod at Peoria, Illinois. Last year, the band played for the 4th of July celebration, and this year made a trip to Waverly to help celebrate the Orphans Festival at the Lutheran Orphans Home in that city. The band has been the feature of the Orphans Annual Festival in Muscatine, and this year was featured at the annual synodical meeting, which was held in Muscatine at the New Girls' Dorm."
Professor Ziegler continued, "It is also interesting to note what becomes of our band players when they go elsewhere. Willie Collins has made good in the town band at West Brooklyn, Illinois, and makes quite a little money playing his bass horn. Margaret Schwartz and Willie Klein are in the band at Wartburg College, Clinton. Miss Haferman and Miss Mathias have both used their clarinet playing ability and band training, which they received in the orphan band, to good advantage both in town bands and school orchestras where they have been playing since leaving the home. Elsie Nelson and Marie Sauer both made good in Muscatine and various orchestras. Other former band members would doubtless make good in music if some arrangements could be made to send them away from the homes with an instrument of their own. Many of them have had to drop music due to the lack of an instrument. Although the leader furnishes most of the band with instruments, he has gone farther and loaned instruments to older boys and girls after leaving the home so they could keep up their music. Earl McKay made the school orchestra in Davenport. The band is small, but fairly well-balanced, and with proper encouragement from the proper sources and proper practice on the part of the individual band members themselves, prospects are for as good a band next year as the Holmes have ever turned out. Of course, not all youngsters are in the band, and not all band members are great players, but enough musical training is given them to have them understand and appreciate music the rest of their lives, and the mental training and physical benefits of music are worthwhile. So all in all, the Holmes, the Kiwanis Club, and the band's leader can all be quite justly proud of our little orphan band.
In the coming years, the band would be periodically disbanded because of financial concerns and lack of money. The February 1930 newsletter contained Professor Ziegler's account of the band, but by the March 1932 newsletter, the Holmes were asking for donations to continue it. The Kiwanis Club needed to cut back their contribution, and the newsletter noted, "Our band had no instruments, so Professor Ziegler loaned them to us. Each year we have tried to buy a few. But although Professor Ziegler loves the children and has a big heart, we cannot ask him to furnish the instruments free forever." Unfortunately, sufficient contributions did not come in, and 2 months later, the newsletter announced that the board of the Holmes made the difficult decision to discontinue the band, at least for the time being. The newsletter said, "We feel we can get along without music for our children, but not without bread and other necessities in these hard times. We hope that when times change again for the better, we can give our children the opportunity to take up music again."
One of the former orphans that was specifically mentioned by Professor Ziegler in this newsletter column was Willie Collins. We discovered that Willie was mentioned in the newsletter several times over a 10-year period starting in August of 1929. Here's how we were first introduced to him. Recently, we were compelled to bring home one of our boys who found a splendid home with the Ackers family near Amboy, Illinois. Willie Collins was in poor health and needed hospital care, so we brought him to the local hospital where the doctor operated on him. He is doing well now, and we hope that he soon can return to Amboy. Mr. and Mrs. Ackers have learned to love the boy and miss him. In July of 1930, Willie returned to the Holmes again because of ill health, but was able to return to the Ackers. Unfortunately, he returned to the Holmes again 2 years later. The August 1932 newsletter said that Willie had to give up his job because of ill health, and the doctor suggested that he go to the sanatorium at Oakdale, Iowa. The Oakdale Sanatorium was established by the state of Iowa in 1907 in response to the tuberculosis epidemic. Tuberculosis is an infectious bacterial disease that mostly affects the lungs. The disease has been around for thousands of years, and from 1600 through the 1800s, it caused about 25% of all deaths in Europe and the U.S., according to the CDC. Sanatoriums were built to isolate TB patients and prevent the disease from spreading. There were 115 sanatoriums in 1904, treating 8,000 people, but by 1953, there were 838 sanatoriums for 136,000 patients. Sanatoriums were no longer necessary in the 1950s because people could be treated with antibiotics at home. The August of 1932 newsletter predicted, "We hope to have Willie back with perfect health within a half a year." Unfortunately, it would be longer than 6 months. In the May of 1935 newsletter, 3 years later, it was reported that Willie was still in Oakdale. Reverend Klein reported at that time, "We were pleasantly surprised last week when Willie Collins, one of our former orphan boys, stopped in to see us. Willie has been in the TB sanatorium for 3 years. He is allowed to be up and around, but must remain there for another year before he will be released. A friend was driving to Muscatine and was kind enough to bring him along."
Unfortunately, Willie had a setback, and a few months later, the October of 1935 newsletter didn't use Willie's name, but talked about his condition in a column entitled "Samaritans Needed." It's unclear who the author of this article was, but here's what it said. The other day, I visited the State Tubercular Sanatorium at Oakdale, Iowa. The state is doing a wonderful piece of work checking the white plague there. Just to interrupt the article for a moment, tuberculosis was commonly known as the white plague because people who suffered from it became very pale. The article continued, "The disease is not as hopeless as it at one time was, but yet I couldn't help asking myself as I passed through between those long rows of white beds, how would you like to be a patient here? I went to the men's ward on the second floor, for there was a young man there I wanted to see. He had grown up in the Lutheran homes, entered when he was only 2 years old, and lived there until he was almost 18. Then the white plague overtook him, and he was sent to Oakdale. He has been there almost 4 years now. He doesn't have a relative in the world. The Ladies' Aid of Pastor Prale's congregation at Iowa City has befriended him, and both Pastor Prale and Pastor Frederick of the Missouri Synod at Iowa City paid him frequent calls. After having been permitted to be up and around, he had taken a turn for the worse and was confined to his bed when I visited him. The doctor did not give me much encouragement. This boy, we won't mention his name, has everything he needs, good food, a radio, medical attention, everything is provided by Muscatine County. But there are a few little things that the county does not provide. Pajamas, handkerchiefs, haircuts, toothpaste, shaving cream, etc. Usually relatives provide these things, but this boy has no relative. Each day, someone comes through the ward and finds out whether or not the patients desire something from town. This man ordered an extra chocolate bar, or a package of gum, or some such little thing. Perhaps he ought to have some writing paper, or a pen and ink. And while the others locate their pocketbooks and hand the attendant a nickel or a dime, this boy merely looks on, for he doesn't have any money. He is our boy. The homes raised him until he was 18. Our treasury cannot afford to provide him with these essentials, but I am wondering whether some of our readers would not be inclined to do something for him. $2 per month, Dr. Edward told me, would amply take care of his needs. It isn't a great amount, and yet what a difference it would make in his life. If you care to provide him with some spending money, send your contributions directly to the homes and they will be forwarded to him, and he will write you a letter telling you he has received it. And if you are not at all too busy, perhaps you would care to correspond with him, so that he too might receive letters occasionally when the mailman comes down the hall, and not feel so lonesome in this good old world. It would be another 4 years before Willie would be released. The October of 1939 newsletter contained the good news. Reverend Klein wrote, "Friends from far and near called on us last month. Willie Collins was included in this group. He informed us that he was entirely cured and released from the Oakdale Sanatorium where he had been for 7 years. This certainly was good news to us, and it is to all of his friends." We wish we could tell you what happened to Willie Collins after his release in October of 1939, but we don't know. We hope that whatever he did and wherever he went, that he remembered his family at the Lutheran homes. His story is an example of how the Kleins and the other workers of the homes considered the children to be their children, even after they grew up and left their care.
September brought the start of the school year. The school was located in a building up on the hill and had 8 grades. Here's what the newsletter said. The orphan school began September 3rd, with Miss Rosa Brower as teacher of the upper 4 grades, and Miss Irene Teuber in charge of the first 4 grades and beginners. The present total enrollment is 34, but this number will probably increase as the school year progresses. Bible history, catechism, and German are taught, besides the regular curriculum of the public schools. On September 26th and 27th, the teachers attended the County Institute. On those days, the girls busily cleaned windows while the boys picked up potatoes in the field. Occasionally, educational films are shown in the school by the Farm Bureau, and the children enjoy these movies very much. In 1929, Iowa law required that children attend school through the 8th grade. In the July 1932 newsletter, Reverend Klein described the examination process. "Our 8th grade pupils also take their exams before the superintendent of our county with the Muscatine children. This is not compulsory, but we do this to show the state officials that our children get a thorough education. and it also encourages our children to work harder. This year, three of our children passed the 8th grade examinations. At present, three of our older children attend high school in Muscatine. We were accustomed in former years to give each one of our pupils a gift of a few dollars for graduation, but we had to refrain from this custom, as we simply do not have it. If a child wanted to attend Muscatine High School, they not only had to pass their exam, but they also had to pay tuition because the children lived outside of town and were not residents of the city itself. The homes simply didn't have the money to pay for tuition, and so the homes would need to find a relative or donor to provide the tuition money. If they were unsuccessful in finding funding, then the child could not go to high school, even though they passed the necessary tests. This all changed in September of 1930, when the homes began to send all eligible children to the high school, even though their tuition was not paid. This resulted in the homes being in the center of a case in the Iowa Supreme Court in 1939.
Andy was a history major and wrote a paper about the Kleins' time at the homes for his college historical methods class. Here's what he wrote about the court case. The case was between the township where the homes were located and the Muscatine School District. The case, entitled School Township of Muscatine County versus Nicholson, centered around whether students from the homes would be responsible to pay their own high school tuition or if the township was required to pay for it because the children resided there. The homes and the Muscatine School District argued that the children were residents of the township and should be eligible for their tuition to be paid by the township. The township argued that the children were only in the homes temporarily and were therefore not residents. The case was tried originally in Muscatine County District Court. Reverend Klein testified at the trial on behalf of the Muscatine School District. He wrote in the Messenger from October of 1938, 76 Township, the district in which they reside, has refused to pay tuition for our orphan children who attend high school. We hope that the decision of the court will be in our favor. The trial court did, in fact, rule in favor of the Muscatine School District and against the township. The judge stated that the children were residents and the township was responsible for paying their tuition. Reverend Klein announced the decision in the Messenger from March of 1939. Our readers will remember that we once wrote of being entangled in a lawsuit. Our township refused to pay tuition for our high school students. The High School of Muscatine took this matter to court, and at such an unseasonable time, too, just before Christmas when the work was most pressing. But we obeyed the law and spent the necessary time on the witness stand. We are happy to report that time and trouble were not in vain. The high school won the case, and from now on, we can send our children to high school without worrying about who will pay the tuition. The township, however, was not willing to accept the decision and appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. The Supreme Court issued a ruling on October 24, 1939, and affirmed the trial court's finding that the children were residents of the township. The court quoted Reverend Klein's testimony. They had no other home in the world than the Lutheran home. The Iowa Supreme Court said the following. The only reasonable conclusion to be reached from a reading of the entire record is that each child either had been abandoned or was abandoned by those whose natural obligation was to care for it shortly after entering the home, and that its sole care, custody, and control was completely surrendered to this benevolent Lutheran organization. The court's ruling recognized that the children had found a home in the township, and it officially relieved the homes of responsibility to pay for tuition with money that the homes simply did not have. We have the original volume from the Iowa Supreme Court that contains the ruling, and you can find a photo of it on our Instagram page at Life at the Homes. You can also see a photo of Reverend Klein with the Orphans Band.
As September comes to a close, Reverend and Mrs. Klein are on a month-long trip to North Dakota to see relatives and friends. At the homes, next month will bring a Halloween celebration and the harvest. But for the United States as a whole, Black Thursday on October 24th and Black Tuesday on October 29th will usher in the Great Depression. We hope you will join us for Episode 11 as we learn more about life at the homes in October of 1929. This podcast was researched and hosted by Andrew Newell and Karen Thaliker, and sound was edited by Robert Newell. Special thanks to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa, for the use of their podcast studio.
If you have additional stories and information about the Lutheran homes of Muscatine from 1921 through 1941, please send us a direct message on our Instagram at Life at the Homes.